Hey, it's Christine with Storyworthy. Today on the show, Simpsons writer Mike Reese tells us a story about Texas banning his children's books.
The state of Texas has banned my children's book, The Boy Who Looked Like Lincoln. And I don't know why. Nobody's telling me why. And so finally they write to me, this woman wrote to me and said, I loved your book till the last page, which is pure pornography. And I go, what? And we see he's got a baby brother who looks like Dick Nixon, right? And these morons in Iowa and Mass and in all of Texas think I called him Dick because he looks like a penis.
Today on the show, Simpsons writer and the host of the podcast, What Am I Doing Here? Mike Reese talks about his children's books being banned in Texas. Stay close.
Hey, my name is Mike Reese, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. By the way, if you are a new listener, you have some catching up to do, because this is, I think, like my 668th episode. Mike Reese.
I'm impressed.
Well, you can call it impressive or stupidity. I mean, it can go either way. I mean, over the years, I have made hundreds of dollars. And anyway, listen, I am here. Well, first of all, let me just say, I hope you listened to the show last week, because last week was a super interesting episode with Mr. What was his first name again?
Mr. Memorable.
With Mr. Ralph Blumenthal. This guy, what an amazing writer. He's written about 7 books, but his most recent book is called The Believer, and it's the true story of Dr. John Mack, who is a Harvard psychiatrist and a Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer who writes about the phenomenon of human encounters with aliens. I mean, not just UFOs, but he talks about, you know, personal encounters with aliens, children that were abducted and brought back, etc. And they do, in fact, you'll be happy to know, Mike Reese from The Simpsons, they do talk about anal probing.
Okay. Now you've got my interest.
You buried the lead.
Literally.
Go back, yeah. You guys. Listen to last week's episode, but not today for sure. Not today, because I have another fantastic talent on the show, and he's from one of my favorite shows, The Simpsons, which has been a part of my life. It's certainly a part of my daughter's life. In fact, I meant to show you, bring it over to show you, Mike. I just started a new 1,000-piece Simpsons puzzle. Which is going to take me forever because the pieces are tiny and everything's yellow. But anyway, we've had several people from The Simpsons on the show, like Dana Gould, Maggie Ross.
I have to interrupt because I have spent all of lockdown just listening to Dana Gould. I listen to his podcast, then I'm listening to Gilbert Gottfried, and Dana's a two-parter. I turn on YouTube. He is a one-man pandemic distraction.
Yeah, he really is a great talent. And we've also had on Phil Rosenthal.
Okay.
And I was good friends, or am good friends, with Maggie Roswell. We played tennis together forever until she moved back to Denver.
Love Maggie. And we, you know, we killed off her main character on the show, and we just keep bringing her back. She was just on our 700th episode.
That's right. And she sings as well sometimes on the episode, which is fun.
She's fantastic.
Yeah, she really was. So she was Ned Flanders' wife. She was Marge. I mean, she was Marge. Right? No,
no,
I mean,
no. Maude Flanders.
She was Maude. Yeah, she was Maude Flanders, who got killed in the best way ever.
Okay.
Wait, what? She felt. Wait, what happened
again? I want to back this up with a little story. I left The Simpsons for 2 years. There's right. 2 years out of the 32 where I was not working there. And then I came in, you know, after 2 years off, and we're pitching a story. I go, oh, why don't we have Maude Flanders come in? And everybody just kind of goes quiet, and you see eyes darting. And I go, what? And they go, we killed her. And I go, why? And the episode hadn't aired yet. They go, we thought it would be funny to kill her with a T-shirt gun.
That's right, in a stadium.
And I'm sitting there going, that's not funny at all. And what have I just, what has happened in the 2 years I've been gone? Who else did you kill? It's weird. It's something I'm not a fan of at all. I hate that. I don't hate much about The Simpsons, but I really don't like that they did that. But they did it. They did it. Yeah. Got Ned a new wife. She died too.
Yeah.
He's like Claus von Bülow.
You know, it's just, you know, as a Simpsons fan, and my daughter is a Simpsons fan, we just, like, you know, and I'm sure, I don't know if you're tired of it after all this time, because it's really been such a part of your life, like you said, over 30 years, but, I mean, the references still come to us every day, Simpsons references.
That's great. It is a great feeling. I love the show. I love my job there. I love the people I work with. One reason, it took me a long time to figure out, one reason the show has run so long is it's such a nice place to be. The actors are nice, animators, writers are all kind to each other. And that's kept it going. We're a frictional environment. The show would not keep going.
Right. So you're saying like Roseanne Barr has never worked on The Simpsons?
No.
Now, your college roommate was Al Jean.
Correct.
And isn't that, I mean, I guess, tell me, just tell me something about that. Because you were, yes. Guys were what, you're 17, 18.
It's an amazing story in that. Al, you know, I'm just some regular guy. Al Jean is a super genius. And he came to Harvard at age 16. He'd quit. He'd skipped a couple of grades. And he came there to be a doctor. And I went to Harvard. I just wanted to join the humor magazine, The Lampoon.
Yeah, you started The Lampoon, or...
No, I didn't start it. I'm one of the very first graduates of the Harvard Lampoon to go on and work in TV and movies. It's just up until then, you'd work on the humor magazine in college, and then you'd go be a funny banker or something like that. And Al Jean and I went professional, and only maybe four people had done that in the previous 150 years the Lampoon had been around. But so Al just saw I was having a lot of fun at the Lampoon, and nobody else has fun at Harvard. So he joined too, and it was never any kind of life goal or ambition. And he was great there. He's a great writer, and we became president and vice president of the Lampoon, and then we went off writing together. But, you know, if it hadn't been for me, Al would have become a doctor and probably cured cancer and COVID and everything. So you're welcome.
I think it's fascinating. And most of the writers on The Simpsons have been mathematicians, scientists, like really bright people.
Very brainy bunch.
Yeah.
Very brainy. In the early days of The Simpsons, the show is so old it predates the internet. And before the internet, we had like six writers on the show, but between them, they knew everything in the world. They were Wikipedia, so we never had to look anything up. If it was a sports question, one guy knew it. If it was history, someone else knew it. Science, entertainment, we had everything covered among these six really brilliant guys.
Well, I mean, that's fascinating. But and now, what are you saying? Now that the writers don't need that kind of knowledge because they can look it up? Is that what you're saying?
Now we use the internet. But until before then, you know, we just didn't need the net. It was a phenomenon. You know, I just used to look at the room and marvel that, gee, we had every answer there.
That's amazing. And not only that, it seems like the talents on The Simpsons, they've also been able to do like most all of the voices. I mean, you take Hank Azaria and Yardling Smith and, you know, they do all the characters.
It's six people who do about 200 recurring characters on the show. And they are amazing.
And you... People out there don't understand why they can't get their foot in the door in voiceover.
Yes, it's you know, everybody wants to break in. And, you know, one person, you know, Simpsons is a good gig and that takes up time. But one, you know, kind of journeyman voice actor can work on 20 different shows. And that's 19 jobs you're not getting because this guy is so versatile and because you can do it so quickly. And now... You can do it from home. You don't even have to drive to the Valley.
Yeah, those people are never giving up those jobs, so just forget it. I have a commercial agent, and she happens to be a huge voiceover agent as well, and I've been with her for like 15 years, and she still won't take me on for voiceover.
Oh, and you have such a beautiful voice. I'm really enjoying it.
Thank you, Mike Reese. You're very sweet. Like we were talking before we started the show, we have a mutual friend, Antal Vigdorsson, who happens to be like a brother to me.
That's great. He's such a great guy. I know him through something. Everyone should look this up. It's icebox.com. I just sent everyone there, and then I realized, oh, it's probably not up anymore.
Oh, no, it's there for sure.
It's still there. Uh-huh. You can. He worked on a company that was literally ahead of its time, where they were putting out a brand new 3-minute cartoon every single day on the internet for free, but it was the days of dial-up internet. So if you wanted to watch the cartoon, you literally had to leave your computer kind of loading all night long, and you could wake up and see the 3-minute cartoon.
Yeah.
But I did a cartoon for him called Queer Duck, about a gay duck. That's my favorite thing I ever did. You can keep The Simpsons, you can keep The Critic, a lot of other stuff I did, but that's the thing I'm really proud of.
Now, Mike, those are big words.
Yeah, I know. Serious. Stupid big words, yeah.
Well, let me just say, first of all, it's iceboxanimation.com.
Oh, okay.
You'll see it right there under our shows, Queer Duck. So they've got several shows. It's all animation, and it's all very smart comedy. But yeah, Queer Duck is there. And I just think that's so interesting that it's still your proudest piece. That's really great. I mean, because you're so accomplished. You've written over 20 children's books, 5 plays, and, you know, like we said, The Simpsons. So those are big words.
Yeah. It's the only thing I did as an act of conscience. It was the year 2000. Mm-hmm. And I read this article. This is stuff no one could believe now, especially a young person hearing this. This article said, there are no gay people on TV. There are no gay characters. And then it was even there going, do you know gay men watch Sex and the City? Because this is the closest thing to gay men on television. And it's like, well, gay, you know, we all know that. But there was literally no gay characters on all of television. And at the same time, which again is hard to believe, in the year 2000, Colorado, which you think of as liberal, banned gay school teachers. Gay people could not teach school. And I said, I want to do something about this. And all I know how to do is make cartoons. So I said, I'm going to do a gay cartoon. I'm going to do a gay Bugs Bunny. And so I invented this cartoon, Queer Duck and his gay animal pals, Oscar Wildcat and Openly Gator and Bipolar Bear. And it was brand new. And, of course, the weird thing about this is I'm not gay. I mean, in modern times, I wouldn't be allowed to even do this. I'm just not gay. It's just, this is the way God made me. So I made the cartoon, and I lived in the, I was in the closet for a year as a heterosexual making this cartoon. And gay people loved it. And I have a shelf full of awards from every gay organization for Queer Duck. And I don't know how good it was. I don't know if it stands. It may look in terrible taste now, but it was the only thing out there. And in fact, when it came on Icebox, it broke the internet. It broke the dial-up internet where something that had been getting a couple thousand hits a day was suddenly getting a few hundred thousand hits a day. There was just such pent-up need to see, you know, a gay cartoon.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that is so special. I think that is super interesting because it was so meaningful to you. And today you bring forth the topic, Texas Banned My Children's Book.
Correct.
And I know you have written 20 children's books. You don't have any children.
Correct.
And so, first of all, it's funny because The Simpsons is for kids on one level, but then they don't get a lot of the other references. So The Simpsons is for kids. But tell me about your children's books.
Okay. Are we going into the story? Or are we,
no,
we're warming
no,
up.
We're not.
It's, first of all, I'll back it up because we've been talking about Al Jean. Al and I, when we were working together, went in to pitch a TV show. And it was sort of modeled on us, and it was supposed to be a children's book writer and an illustrator, you know, a comedy team, the writer and an illustrator. And the writer, I think, was a family guy with kids, and the illustrator had no children. And And the executive we took it to just said, this is impossible. Nobody who works in children's books could have no children. And I said, no, nobody. I said, none of them had children. Dr. Seuss and Maurice Sendak and Lewis Carroll and Hans Christian Andersen and the guy who wrote Peter Pan, the woman who wrote Peter Rabbit. None of them had children. And
is that true?
It is absolutely true. It is, I would say, a majority, you know, and very few people don't have kids. I think it's 10% of people don't have kids, but 50% of children's book writers don't have kids. But, you know.
That is so fascinating. I'm just saying, because I work at a bookstore and I didn't know that.
Yeah. So that's it. I'm one of them.
Yeah. No, I think it's fascinating. And do you still use, or do you use the same illustrator book to book?
No, that's a great, another great story, which is, when you sell a children's book, at least in my experience, you sell the manuscript and then you see the book when it comes out. You have no input on the illustrations whatsoever. So there's a guy, the guy who illustrated the two books I'll talk about. This guy has done seven of my children's books. I don't know who he is. I don't know where he lives. We've never even exchanged an email. And this is the real funny story. I think my fifth children's book, the illustrator got hold of me. You know, he somehow tracked me down. He said, look, I'm not supposed to do this, but let me show you some of the illustrations I'm working on. You know, it's, and he sends me the illustrations, and he did a beautiful job on it. But I said, look, I like everything you did except the little boy in this book. The little boy looks like a girl, and his mouth is always open in a big O, and he looks like a toilet. I said, so everything's great except the little boy looks like a girl toilet. And he writes back to me, that's my son.
Oh, get out of here. What did you respond?
Suddenly I realized, oh, that's why they keep writers and illustrators separate.
That is too much. That is too much, Mike. And it's very interesting. I did not know any of that. So I'm excited to hear about that. I love all that inside baseball when it comes to bookstores. It's so rare now, really.
Yeah.
So it's pretty cool. All right. So listen, let's get over to your story. Like I said, your topic today, Texas banned my children's books. First of all, if you were going to say to me, Christine, who do you think would have banned my books? I probably would have said Texas.
Yes.
Or even Colorado, because Colorado is kind of right down the middle. Oh, yeah, sure, you got your hippie dopers in Boulder, and you got all these cool people in the mountains. But then you also have a lot of people who are running from something, and then they go hide in the mountains. And there's a lot of guns, and there's a lot of hunting, and there's a lot of weird people who don't want to – it's almost like the people that go to Alaska, you know, not to – be totally generalizing, but sure, I will. You know why, Mike?
Why?
It's my podcast.
Good for you. I was just in Alaska last week, and I can tell you that for sure. Everyone's running from something. Nobody chose to be there.
Yeah, nobody wants to, like, socialize. You know, that's not what Alaska's all about. Hey, also, since you were just traveling, I did want to mention your new podcast is so good.
Oh,
there's only
you.
Two episodes out, and the trailer's out as well. But it makes me laugh so hard. It's called Where in the Hell Am I?
No, that's what everyone calls it, though. And it is. It's always some version of that. It's called What Am I Doing Here? I'm going to get the plug in now, and then we'll plug it later. But it's really fun. It's just meant to be funny. And it's on top of writing for The Simpsons and writing these children's books, I've been to 134 countries.
That is so unbelievable.
I mean,
that's a lot. I was a flight attendant, and I've only been to half that many.
I've been to 134. I've been to the North Pole and the South Pole. I climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. I've been to North Korea and Iran and Iraq. And I've just boiled that down to these funny 15-minute podcasts, and it's all funny. It's like, I've been to nice places. There's nothing funny about them. You won't hear about it. You won't hear about Portugal on this podcast. But please check it out, and it's on the Believe Network, BLEAV, and you can find it on Apple and Spotify and everything. But it's called What am I doing here?
What am I doing here? And by the way, you know who you remind me of when you're talking about all that traveling is our friend Tal Victorson.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yes. He has been to Iran. He has climbed Mount Kilimanjaro.
Oh.
Yeah. I think he's been to North Korea. Oh. He and his wife have been everywhere. Everywhere.
There are people like us. We find each other and it gets a little competitive sometimes.
And so the podcast I just listened to this morning, I was losing it laughing because it's talking about Costa Rica, right? And what a hole it is. I had a boyfriend who always used to go to Costa Rica like twice a year. And I'm like, well, what do you do? Are there any museums? He's like, no. And I'm like, well, is the food good? He's like, not really. I'm like, well, what's the deal? He's like, because everybody's just hanging out.
Oh,
and I'm like,
God.
Wow, sounds dreadful.
The one thing I do on the podcast is I tell you places you'd never want to go that are great, like Iran. Iran is just a lovely place. Syria, up until a couple of years ago, was a beautiful place to visit. But then I tell you about places like Costa Rica that everybody thinks is great, and you get there and you go, there's nothing, it just rains all the time. Costa Rica, I had a really bad time in. And the other one is Alaska. Not that Alaska's bad, but we went to see the Northern Lights. And anyone will tell you the Northern Lights, they're beautiful, and they're not. They don't look like anything in person. They photograph really beautifully. But they look like crap in person. They look like, and they're just gray. There's no color in them at all. And, you know, nobody will tell you that because they got, you know.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
That can't be. Well, then what's the green that we see, like the big stripes?
I couldn't believe, you know, I wouldn't have believed, and I did this twice. First, I went to Iceland to see them, and they're all gray. And then I looked through people's camera viewfinder, and sure enough, they're all colored. It's like a camera trick. They just photograph better. I always compare them to Julianne Moore because she's so beautiful in the movies. And then I saw her at Ralph's one day. I go, oh, there's nothing there. So
you are out of your mind. That yeah. is so funny. She is the most beautiful woman. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Okay, so
okay.
You purposefully went to Iceland
to see the Northern Lights. And again, they look like nothing. So then here, 5 years, 10 years later, my wife says, let's go to Alaska to see the Northern Lights. And I said, we went. They suck. She goes, this is Alaska. You know, they'll have American Northern Lights. And sure enough, we're out there in the freaking cold at midnight. And they just look like nothing. They look like God's ashtray. They just...
Is it like the van picks you up at the hotel and then they take you to see the Northern Lights and then they bring you back?
We had to drive like an hour from the hotel, from Fairbanks, which is...
But you weren't driving.
No. We had a guy pick us up. No, one time my wife drove. These are all... That's the other thing about the podcast is it's sort of a love story in that I've been to 134 countries. I don't want to go anywhere. I don't want to travel one bit. My wife loves to travel, and I love my wife, and so we go, you know, we go. So we go places.
That is so interesting. And when you travel, do you go, like, let's say you're going to a country in Africa, do you go on, like, kind of the luxury camping experience, or do you do more of, a middle of the road, or are you going to the Jolly Rancher in Sydney?
We go cheap. We go cheap. This is how my wife, I'm Jewish. I know people can tell just by the way I talk. My wife is Catholic, but she is the real cheapskate of the family. And, you know, she can't resist the bargain. And so she'll go, oh, things are really cheap in this country. And I go, yes, they just had an earthquake. That's why they're cheap. And we'll go, this is such a great story from our life. We're watching TV one night. And the news, it was a bulletin. They go, 60 tourists have just been gunned down in Cairo. And my wife goes, we've got to go. And I said, why? And she goes, she said, because nobody's going to be visiting. And I go, yeah, 60 hotel rooms just opened up.
Oh, God. By the way, were you disappointed with Cairo or not?
No. I mean, the city is that, but the pyramids are the greatest thing I've seen in my life. You don't think so?
Are you lying to me? Well, I actually haven't been, but I've...
What kind of a thing is that? I
recently talked to... Bassem Youssef, you know, and he's a comedian, and he's really was very, very famous in Egypt until they basically ousted him.
Yeah.
But he's Egyptian, and he said as well that, you know, there's a McDonald's, a pyramid, a Pizza Hut, a pyramid.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yes. I mean, it's
what's
a place.
What's so great about that?
The pyramids are the greatest thing in the world. They are the greatest thing to see. This is what I always say is, tour, you know, the world's great sites are not like some Wes Anderson movie where everybody tells you, oh, this is great, and you go, oh, this is sucks. And, you know, the great things in world travel are really great. The Great Wall of China is great. The Grand Canyon is really deep, you know?
And grand.
Yeah, that's it. The pyramids are fantastic, that kind of thing. There's very few major disappointments in world travel.
Right, except for Costa Rica. Smells like a damp sock. It's, like everything's wet.
Everything is wet all the time.
Do most people wear shoes in Costa Rica, or is it just like a flip-flop thing?
I got to say, I didn't look at people's feet. I think they wear boots because it's mud. It's friggin' mud everywhere. And it's in the podcast, but it sounds like vaudeville, but it was true. It was just like... It says, we can't. I told the guy, why is it raining every day hard? And I go, we came in the dry season. And the guy goes, yes, it rains a lot in the dry season. And I go, well, when does it rain the least? He goes, in the rainy season. So,
what
it's
the
like,
hell?
Are you sure you know what rain is? Are you aware? You understand this concept?
Oh, man. I'm so happy you're here, Mike. And I can't wait to hear your story about your children's books being banned in Texas. But before we get to Mike's story, I wanted to remind you guys that we are playing Story Smash, the storytelling game show, every Friday night, live on Facebook and YouTube at 7 p.m. Pacific time. And I got to tell you, everybody's back. Danny Zucker's on the show. Blanca Patch is on the show. Last week, Mary Birdsong came along. We've had Wendy McLennan Covey and Wayne Fetterman. So you've got to check out Story Smash. It's so damn funny. It's a tight hour of entertainment. And Mike Reese, I would be so delighted if you would come on as an expert judge.
Oh, I don't know. Let me listen to it first. Especially half those people are friends of mine. I don't want to judge them. So.
We have, oh no, no, they're all the judges. That's what I mean.
Oh, okay.
So we have three expert judges per show, and then there's four contestants. The contestants are all comics, and they come on, they spin a wheel, and then they tell a true 1 minute story on whatever they land on. And if they go over their time, there's a clock. If they go over their time, there's a big smash. We go right to the judges, they comment, hilarity ensues.
Fantastic.
Yeah, tune in, you guys. Story Smash every Friday night. Head over to StorySmashShow.com to find out more about the show. And if you want to play, you can always shoot me an email, and you'll find that address at StorySmashShow.com. And, of course, follow the show on Instagram at StorySmash. Okay, you guys, Mike Reese is here. You've heard him talking. As you know, he's a writer who's worked with The Simpsons for over 30 years. And you guys have picked up how many Emmy Awards? You have four personally?
I have four Emmys, yes. The show is one.
32.
Correct.
Right. And you also have a Peabody, right?
I have two Peabodies.
Two Peabodies. You're a Harvard graduate. So much to be impressed by. You wrote a wonderful book called Springfield Confidential, Jokes, Secrets, and Outright Lies from a Lifetime of Writing for The Simpsons. And I got to tell you, come on. Like I said, if you go into my daughter's room, everything is Simpsons. She has every doll from, Universal Studios has the big Simpsons world that we've all been in 1,000 times. And we just are huge fans. So, again, I'm so thrilled that you're here. And, you know, anybody who works on The Simpsons, your mind just has to work so quickly. I mean, do you feel like you're always ahead of what's going to be said, Mike?
I do watching other TV, yeah. I always go, oh, come on. I sit there a lot going, you could have done better than that. You know, we work really, really hard at The Simpsons. And I did the math where I go, every joke on the show is the work of six people in a room working for a solid hour. Everything, anything that's on screen for, you know, 2 seconds, an itchy and scratchy title, that'll take a group of people an hour, 2 hours to think of. So I see it. I see when people are getting lazy. And then on the flip side, I started watching Rick and Morty. I'm the last guy to come to this show. And I go, how do they do it? I don't know. I know how much work that must be to make that show. And who wants to work that hard? I think it's that amazing, that dense and great.
But yeah.
Just me, just my opinion.
It's like every joke that happens, there have to be, you know, you have to think out every single tag that could have come.
Yeah.
Every single thing, yeah. We have a script from Matt Groening gave to Patton Oswalt, who's a friend of mine, and he gave it to my daughter because she's a big fan, like I said. And it's really sweet how she pours through it, and she looks at every single, you know, direction, and she's so, you know, into it. I love it. She's going to an art school. She's going to an arts high school. So, I mean, she's in the realm of Los Angeles. I don't know how to explain it, but like it's also tangible to her,
mm-hmm.
you know, because she knows people that have been animators, or she knows, you know, the voice actors, etc. She knows who I talk to, and so she sees it. It's all very it could happen, you
it
know
can
you
happen yeah
do anything you want.
It's something born in you. When I was a kid, I was little, like 5, and I'd watch a comedian on TV, and I'd always go, he would get a laugh, and I would go, I wish I wrote that. I never wanted to be the comedian, but I always assumed there was a guy right backstage with the typewriter handing the stuff out. And I thought, I want to be that guy. And
yeah,
I'm that guy.
Well, you know, this show, Storyworthy, I have on about 90% comedians because, and I'm a comic too, believe it or not, but I love the way you think. That it's just so intelligent. It's just like comedians are some of the brightest people I've ever met because their minds are just going far faster than yours are, than the normal person, it seems to me.
I think. I think so. And it's interesting, too, that comedy writers and comedians are different animals. They're not quite the same. There's a major overlap, and certainly you can go back and forth, but they're very different. I think comedy writers I see are very stable people in long-term relationships, have very few neuroses. And then somebody told me 90% of comedians are clinically depressed. And
sure,
I get it. And you would think, oh, we're all the same thing, but they're I don't know, like cats and dogs. Pretty similar, but very different.
Yeah, no, I know, you know, like my buddy Matt Oswalt, he's a writer. He's probably, you probably follow him on Twitter.
Yes, he's
like
hilarious.
One of the funniest guys. Yeah, oh my God, forget it. But he's not a stand-up.
Yep.
And so it is that. And by the way, you are so funny on Twitter. You guys can find Mike over at Mike Reese Writer on Twitter. And of course, follow me over there as well at Storyworthy. All right, let's hear the story. I can't wait. Wherever you are, folks, put your hands together for Mike Reese.
All right. All right. Yes, as we mentioned, I've written 20 children's books. And this is a stretch for me because I hate children. But Dr. Seuss hated children. And Maurice Sendak hated children. And Lewis Carroll loved children in a way that's illegal in 48 states. And I said that one night, and a hand went up and asked, what are the two states where it's okay? And that's how I met Woody Allen. So I'm going to tell you about the first two children's books I wrote. The first one took me 25 years to write. The second one took me 2 hours. Which one is better? They're about the same. So the first children's book came to me, I was 15 years old, and I was watching How the Grinch Stole Christmas for like the 10th year in a row. And I loved it. And I loved it better than anything on TV. And it was back in the days when you just had to wait a solid year to see it again. So I'm 15 years old, and I said, I want to make something as good as this. Now, I never had any dream of being a writer. I certainly never knew I would wind up in animation. I just said, I want to do this one thing with my life. So I just started thinking. And for the next 15 or 20 years, I was just trying to think of an original children's book about Christmas, a new Christmas story. And finally, 20 years later, I thought I had it. And I go to a party and I see my friend Pat Verone, and I tell him my idea for a children's book. And he said, that was an old SNL sketch. So there's 20 years work down the drain.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So I start thinking again. I put another...
What was that sketch? I got to hear this.
It was a sketch with John Lovitz, who I wound up working with years later, called Hanukkah Harry, about the Santa Claus of Hanukkah.
Yeah.
So
wow.
So that was it. So I just pitched that aside, and I spent another couple of years trying to come up with a new children's book. And this time I thought of something, and I didn't tell Pat Verone. So I said, all right, if it's out there, I don't want to hear about it. And so then I start writing this children's book, and I wanted it to be perfect. And so I spent 6 years writing 600 words. And I remember I finished it on an all-nighter. I pulled an all-nighter. It was like 5 in the morning. I'm done. I turn on the radio. Howard Stern is on. And his guest was a crazy homeless woman. And he'd been making fun of this homeless woman. And then he says to her, is there anything nice I can do for you? And the crazy homeless woman goes, can you publish my children's book? And Howard goes on this beautiful rant how every idiot in America thinks they can write a children's book. And I remember he said the line, any yenta who tells their kid a bedtime story thinks that could be a children's book. Well, you're all morons. And here I am. I'm that moron. I've just finished my first children's book. And sure enough, he's right. I sent out the children's book to the 12 children's book publishers in America. They all read it. They all reject it. I got personalized rejections on the book. So I'm thinking, there's 30 years work down the drain. And then I find a 13th publisher. It's Price, Thurn, Sloan, the people who do Mad Libs, also publish children's books. And I send them the book, and they buy it. And before the book comes out, I said to the editor, I go, how many of these do you think you're going to sell? And he said, in children's books, 9,000 copies is considered a bestseller. 9,000. So my book comes out, and it sells 180,000 copies. 180,000. This is the book everyone else had read and rejected. We outsold Harry Potter for 2 weeks. Harry Potter.
Oh my God.
There's the new Harry Potter book. We kicked his butt for 2 weeks. Then the book became an animated special. I got it about 10 years after that. I turned it into an animated special. It aired 40 years to the week from the time I had the original idea. For exactly 40 years, probably, I wish I could say to the day, but I couldn't look that up. 40 years to the week, it finally comes out. And since then, they've run it every year for 6 years in a row, and they pair it with How the Grinch Stole Christmas. So that would be a lovely story. I should end there, but it's a little sentimental and self-serving. So let me tell you about my second children's book.
Wait, I need to know the name of that.
It's called How Murray Saved Christmas.
And How Murray Saved Christmas, and Murray is the dog.
Murray is a guy who runs a deli at the North Pole. He's a Jewish guy. It was Jerry Stiller in the animated special.
Oh, how perfect.
And that was it. Santa Claus gets knocked out on Christmas Eve. They said, who can deliver the toys? And they look at Murray's Deli, and it says free delivery. So they hire this crabby Jewish guy to deliver the toys all over the world. And he is crabby. And then you see he's got a dark secret past, and he winds up doing a very lovely job. And it's a really nice special. It's a musical, and it's going to be a play. This, again, it was a book that everyone rejected. It's now going to be a musical in London starting in December 1st.
Oh.
So it goes and goes. So
that's so exciting.
It's really been nice. It's been such a pleasure.
Beautiful, yeah.
Anyway, so now let me crap all over my own story with this the second, much shorter story. So that was my first book, literally 40 years from conception to hitting TV. This next one came in 2 hours. I'm asleep. I wake up at 2 a.m. I've had this crazy dream, and because I'm a writer, I have a pad and paper by the bed, and I wrote it down. I went back to sleep, and when I woke up in the morning, I had forgotten all about it. If I hadn't written it down, it just wouldn't have existed. And but it was a book called, it was a story called The Boy Who Looked Like Lincoln. And it's about an 8-year-old boy who looks exactly like Abraham Lincoln. He's got the hat, he's got the beard, he's got the wart, he's Lincoln, and all the other kids at school make fun of him. So his parents send him to a camp for kids who look like things. And he meets a boy who looks like a light bulb, and a girl who looks like a toaster, and 4 kids who look like Mount Rushmore. And in the end, he learns it's not important what you look like. What matters is who you are. Now, that doesn't explain why supermodels make more than school teachers, but what the hell? It's a kid's book.
Right.
Right? So that's the book. And I write it, I find it that morning. I type it up. I email it to the publisher. He buys it that afternoon. So it took 12 hours from conception to sale. And I'm proud of this book. I'm proud of it because I think it's going to bring comfort to ugly children everywhere. And there are so many ugly children. I know. I've been to Chuck E. Cheese. And so the book comes out. And again, I think I've done something good for the world. And then I start getting hate mail. A librarian in Springfield, Mass., Springfield, writes to me, says, "We pulled your book off the shelves of our school library." A minister in Iowa says, "We burned your book in our church parking lot," which is not so bad because before they burn it, they've got to buy it. And then I read in the paper, the state of Texas has banned my children's book, The Boy Who Looked Like Lincoln. And I mean, I'm shocked to hear there are books in Texas, but the entire state has banned my book, and I don't know why. Nobody's telling me why, and finally I get a letter saying, "I loved your book." By the way, if anyone thinks the story is not true, go to the Amazon page for The Boy Who Looked Like Lincoln. You can see the whole debate playing out on the comments, and it's all 5 stars and 1 star, and so... Anyway, so finally they write to me, this woman wrote to me, said, "I loved your book till the last page, which is pure pornography." And I go, "What?" And I spent a month looking at the last page of my book, and finally I see it. It's the last page of the book, the boy who looked like Lincoln becomes elected class president, and he says, "I feel better about myself. I hope I can help my baby brother, Dick." And we see he's got a baby brother who looks like Dick Nixon, right? And these morons in Iowa and Mass and in all of Texas think I called him Dick because he looks like a penis.
What idiots.
Yes, and I mean, Dick Nixon looked like a penis. I'll grant you that. Look at his nose and his testicular jowls. But the kid in the book he's doing V's for victory.
Yeah, he's doing that.
He's got a 5 o'clock shadow. He's got a little tape recorder. He's Dick Nixon. So... this taught me 3 things about the people who ban children's books. Next time you hear about children's books being banned, you'll know 3 things about them, which is they have no sense of history, they have no sense of humor, and they have filthy, filthy minds.
Well, that is so true. I mean, my gosh, we've seen it play out with so many politicians and all those people that were... arrested and put in jail of Trump's team. You know, you look at Manafort and all those people. It's all the same.
Yep.
It's so crazy.
Yep.
Now, let me ask you, Mike, when you made the first book you were talking about with the children that all looked like,
that book.
The Lincoln book, that they all looked like something else. Were you thinking of like the land of misfit toys? Because it sounds like you're childhood, you know, talking about the Grinch Stole Christmas, or maybe, I mean, I don't know, but about you, but like for me, it was like the Peanuts, the Charlie Brown,
right, love
Christmas, and that animation, that type of animation was always so great to me.
Yeah, I love that stuff, and as much as it was a real doubleheader, my inspiration was the Grinch and Charlie Brown Christmas. And there's two things about those. It's amazing. I think they probably came out around the same time. Is they're buoyant. They're smart and they're gripping and they make you a better person watching them. You are filled with joy and inspiration that, you know, you can be a better person. And even as a kid, I realized the whole rest of TV doesn't do that for you. TV can be entertaining or time, it kills time. But you know, very little of it really touches you and reaches you the way those two specials did.
Well, you know, you look at sitcoms and they're trying to make so many laughs happen per page.
Right.
And Charlie Brown was just more stretched out. And you didn't necessarily laugh out loud. You just kind of like identified, really.
Mm-hmm. It's an amazing thing. Matt Groening always called it, called Peanuts the most depressing comic strip ever.
Well, yeah. And I don't know if you've read the book about Charles Schulz. You know, I'm trying to think of the name of it. I'm going to look it up real quick here. The book about it had a yellow cover.
Yeah, I read that. It's a great book.
It's just called Schulz is what it's called. And it is, yeah, it's called Schulz and Peanuts, a biography written by David Michaelis. Yeah, and so on the cover of the book, it's just that yellow with the black line. So you know it's Charlie Brown. That book is so fascinating about Charles Schulz's life.
Yeah.
You know, and coming from that Christian background in Minnesota and the deep cold and how they played ice hockey. And then when you read this book, you see where it all came from. You know, you see where they keep showing like Zambonis, you know, the way the teachers talk. And it was just all his upbringing. And even between the houses, you know, the side walks and what you would see. It was really his world, Stark Pond, all that stuff.
Yep. Yeah, it's remarkable. There's a story really stuck with me was there was a woman he loved, I think, in art school, and they were going to get married, and she finally broke up with him because she said, "You're too ambitious. I don't want to marry an ambitious man." It was such a funny flip on the story you hear all the time.
Yeah.
But he just, his dreams were too big for her. And I don't know if she regretted that or.
Well, and then the story that stuck with me was that later in his life, I'm going to say he was 60, 65 when he started dating his, assistant, personal assistant or somebody who was like, oh, I don't know, 20, 25.
Yeah.
I think she was like, maybe she sold hamburgers in the skating rink. I'm not sure because he built that big hockey rink up in Santa Rosa, California for the community. And he started dating a much younger woman. He and his wife split. He married the younger woman. This really, you know, it's like he had this whole hardcore Christianity background. But then later in life, you know, who knows?
Yeah, she said, it's in the book, it sticks with you. She said he was very sexual.
Yeah, which, what's happening?
You know, if you picture the guy, you go, all right.
Yeah, I'm not thrilled about that. But I am thrilled about you coming on the show, Mike. Really, I think you're just a fascinating person. And let me just ask you one more question, and I know we got to go. But where do you think all this comes from? Like your creativity, and it's just like there seems to be a well in you, and you can just keep bringing it up. How is this happening?
This, I just think this is the way I am. This is it. And I always look at the other Simpsons writers. There's a 20-ish now, about 20 writers. And I go, they're all from random places. They're all from small towns scattered all over America. Nobody's from a showbiz family. Nobody studied for this. It's just sort of how you're born. The thing I always compare myself to is, I get the question a lot and I grapple with it. I go, oh, I'm like a chicken. A chicken just makes an egg every day. You know, it just comes out of them. And people go, wow, this is delicious. This is great. It's like, all right, sure. And they go, can we eat this? And the chicken's thinking, well, you know, it was just in my ass, but okay.
Well,
and that's it. I'm just a chicken. I get, you know, every once in a while, just something starts to form in me. And I said, let me get this out of here. Let me get it out of me so I don't have to think about it anymore. And so I'm done. Once I've written it, I just go, oh, I feel much better. And then if anything happens with it, that's great.
But the thing is, you obviously nurture your art, you know, and I think that that's really impressive. So, like, do you play any instruments or?
Nope.
Sorry?
No, I have no other talents or skills. I can't type. I can't parallel park. I can't skate. I can't ski. I can't sing. I can't do the simplest dance. This is it. I'm glad I can do one thing. And I'm glad it's a job and somebody pays for it.
Well, you're damn good at it. And I'm just so happy to talk to you, really. I think now I'd like to have a new friend.
Okay, let's be friends.
Let's be friends. All right, you guys, one more time. This has been so much fun. Make sure you follow Mike over there on Twitter at Mike Reese. At Mike Reese Writer. Yeah. At Mike Reese.
R-E-I-S-S.
That's it. R-E-I-S-S. Yep. Mike Reese Writer. And then follow me as well over there at Storyworthy. And don't forget to tune in to Story Smash, the storytelling game show, every Friday night, streaming live on Facebook and YouTube. It's ridiculous. A couple of weeks ago, Wendy Liebman, she told me she beat her pants. How do you like that?
Excellent.
Big things happen over there. All right, you guys, one more time on behalf of the very talented Mike Reese. Thanks so much, friend. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
My name is Christine Blackburn saying, make it a story worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Story Worthy podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.